York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot of interesting insight to share today, of course, starting with health and healing. But then we're going to look at some of the ways that we misunderstand movements. And more often than not, the people who head those movements become the focus of our attention. They become celebrities. Now, if they're coming from a very good place and they're mature and they're not into just self-interest, we learn something about them and the movement. But my experience has been that many times when people do not understand the importance of their own life, they're not grounded in a sense of completeness, they find a good movement to, in effect, sublimate the emptiness of their own self. So people hide in movements. They can become famous. They can become, spokesperson for that movement. But that means the movement's more important than the rest of their life, or that's the only life they have. I have found that to be true with some of the people in the feminist movement. And I believe that those individuals use the movement and its importance in seeing that equality for all women and no repression, no limitation, no subjugation should be in existence. And then I see what it becomes and the direction they take it. Even well-intentioned people can take a good movement in the wrong direction. But there was one person who stood up and stood out. And when this person saw that there was something wrong, she called it out. Her name is Paglia. And we're going to play a segment of her today, along with another feminist, discussing this. I'll play some of it, because I believe that it is now time for the third wave of feminism. I worked with one of the leading second wave feminists, one of the most respected feminists, because she was a diplomat. She was an ambassador. She didn't like all the fighting amongst the women themselves. She certainly didn't like male-hating, and we did a lot of work together. We wrote a best-selling book together for women only, 1,600 pages, probably the longest book I'm aware of ever written on women's issues. We toured together. We spent years in communicating and friendship. I had an enormous amount of respect for Barbara Seaman. She died about 10 or 11 years ago. She was, 85. So, and she commented a couple times she would have lived a longer life had she started her journey of health earlier. That was the second wave, and it was divided. Those who were very political, and it was all about what's wrong with men. Men were the cause of everything. And there were those, like herself, who said that's not correct. And then it was those who managed to get the media behind them. And that whole movement was kind of swept aside, at least the more humanistic parts. Now we have an opportunity to go forward by looking at what is right for men and women, helping both men and women to evolve where they have respect, appreciation, for each other, are willing to cooperate and work, and yet both maintain what is uniquely their own perspective. There's a whole movement now to denigrate masculinity, to feminize young boys. I think that is so pernicious and so wrong. So we're going to be exploring this. I'm going to be sharing with you voices that normally you would not have heard, and certainly not on many of the airwaves, that are taking a very hard, radical approach against men. This is also being co-joined with the loss of free speech movement, those who pride themselves in making sure that you don't have free speech. They don't want you to hear certain voices. They believe they have a right for you not to hear them, to demand that. Take away those forms. Shame anyone who disagrees with them. Denigrate them. Attack them. Libel. Slander them. The mainstream media is going to be on their side. Most colleges, university will be on their side. You are aware that today many people, Dick Gregory and certainly Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, some of the best of the comedians who were intelligent enough to bring some of the most important issues, but to mock them, ridicule them, and we could laugh at ourselves and laugh at what they were showing us. Those individuals would not be invited, and are not. Many comedians are not going onto college campuses because the rule is you cannot say anything that would be offensive. You cannot make anyone feel uncomfortable. You cannot make anyone by your conversation feel threatened in any way. It's gotten that absurd. So I'm going to be addressing that. It is time now for reasonable and responsible pushback to this lunacy that's going on and how quickly people become involved in it, especially young, mindless people. And that's unfortunately too many of them. People who have not gone into the world, who have committed nothing to making it a better world, who have not been in the workplace, who have not communicated with other cultures in the real world, do not look at the sanctity of a college, the comfort of a dorm, and as being in the real world. And yet you're demanding how everyone else in the real world should live and think. Wrong. You're going to get a pushback like you've never believed possible, and I intend to offend you in every way I humanly can, using intellect, wisdom, common sense, reason, humor, something none of which you're used to, not in the environment you grew up in, not in the universities we now have. They're an embarrassment. So I intend to take them on and bring people to your airwaves. Yes, even these Pacifica airwaves are unbridled censorship, radicalized polemic, some of the dumbest commentators in history. But they believe they're right, and they believe you shouldn't hear someone. Anyhow, it's coming at you, and I don't believe in censorship. If you don't like what you hear, you can always change the channel. But what if you didn't have an opportunity to hear someone that could have opened you to a different reality? So you're going to hear a lot of people, Brendan O'Neill and many others, Joanna Williams, people who I believe deserve to be heard. Today, my guest in the second part of our program is someone you really need to hear. And unfortunately, most people have not had that opportunity. He is Professor Peter Edelman. He is the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Law and Public Policy at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. Quite simply, is one of our nation's leading authorities on the economics, politics, and law behind poverty and welfare of juvenile justice. He was the former legislative assistant to Senator Robert Kennedy up until Robert Kennedy's assassination, and went on to be the deputy director of the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Human Rights. He was also a member of the Clinton administration and famously, and good for him, resigned in opposition to the Clinton signing of the welfare reform legislation. He was also a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg. He received his law degree, Harvard Law, and he is the author of Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. So we're going to talk about the criminalization of poverty in America. Interesting, you would think that no one based upon the media and all these movements accepted that poverty exists in America. It does. Along all races and all backgrounds. And we're going to talk about it because it's my firm belief that we should not penalize someone for being poor. We should abolish all prisons, private prisons that put poor people in there, and we should have a debt forgiveness program. If we could forgive the debt, $21 trillion of Wall Street, we certainly have the capacity to forgive the debt of people who are not in the same position as Wall Street. We always like to begin by giving you the latest on health and healing. This comes from Aokiyama University School of Medicine, Japan. And it's a simple article. It's about the neuro, meaning your brain, your neurons, protective effect of fermented papaya. Now, most people have never heard of fermented papaya. We know fermented beets and cabbage and soy. But yes, on apple cider. Apple cider is fermented apples. But papaya, it's something new. But it activates what is called the NRF2 pathway in the astrocytes, and it protects your brain. That's the simple takeaway method of it. You can get fermented papaya in health food stores. My suggestion is, if you want a healthier brain, protecting your neurons, have a teaspoon each day. Also, there was a separate article from the Korean Institute for Oriental Medicine on the anti-inflammatory and hyperextension of that inflammation in the body. And it comes from maple leaf extract. And that's important too. So again, something that's easy to get, inexpensive, and it can turn off inflammation in the body. That's important. Another research study from Monash University in Australia shows that a single dose of a polyphenol-rich seaweed extract could help. And this was a double-blind placebo crossover study on glycemic control, meaning your blood sugar. Something simple. Brown seaweed. Very common, inexpensive. Lots of Asian people use it and have used it for millennia. And in this double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized crossover study, the effectiveness of just a simple dose of this polyphenol-rich extract made a difference in bringing down blood sugar. So if you're pre-diabetic and diabetic, or if you're overweight, your blood sugar tends to be higher. That's dangerous. That can lead to macular degeneration, glaucoma, kidney failure. It's really bad. So start to think about having a single serving of sea vegetables each day. Now, there are different sea vegetables. There's wakame and kombu and hijiki and nori and brown seaweed. They're all good. They're all terrific. In this case, it was just 2 grams. Tell you how little that is. It's 28.35 grams to an ounce. And this is 2 grams? 2 grams is like a teaspoon. This was the fucus, F-U-C-U-S, extract. But I'm willing to bet that almost any good seaweed could help you. It also helps your thyroid gland. Gives you those minerals that are unique from the sea. Then we have from Maastricht University in the Netherlands, why nutrition education is inadequate in the medical curriculum. And according to news reporting out of the Netherlands, they said, the prevention of nutrition care by doctors is important in promoting healthy dietary habits. And such interventions can lead to reductions in disease morbidity, mortality, and medical cost. However, medical students and doctors report inadequate nutrition education and preparedness during their training at school. So finally, they're acknowledging something that everyone has been aware of, all the doctors I've ever interviewed and know as friends. Almost all their education is in pharmacology. To that, they are very adept, and very little, from a couple hours to the maximum of a week of education in their whole medical curriculum, to nutrition. Almost none to psychoneuroimmunology, none to environmental causation, none to stress and its impact upon the body, and none to exercise. So the very things that allow you to live a longer life that the scientific literature supports, with tens of thousands of studies, nutrient deficiencies like vitamin D, vitamin A, vitamin C, calcium, magnesium, exercise, de-stressing, all of those are more important than any pharmacological reference when it comes to keeping you alive, because there's no pill that you could take, no drug ever invented that can take the place of sunshine, that can prevent cancer, that can prevent arteries from clogging, that keep your neurons healthy, that can extend the life of the neutrophils, basophils, leukocytes. But food can, and yet there is no emphasis. If anything, that should explain why so often your doctor cannot provide you with information they're simply not aware of. So what is the solution? To have a national forum where physicians from both the Orthodox model and physicians who were in the Orthodox model but also chose to step out of that Orthodox model and go beyond it, of which there are at least 3,000, bring those two groups together. Then those of us who are not medical doctors, but we actually have far more knowledge about the body and its health and prevention than any medical doctor, those of us who have legitimate PhDs in nutrition, and there are very few who do, that all sit down and bring the studies, make it science-based, and say, here's what should be known about disease prevention and disease treatment, and then see if there can be a consensus of how then to take a syllabus back into medical schools to enlarge the database for physicians. Now, that will be fought at every level by all those who would lose some control and profit, the pharmaceutical industry, for example. But if this is done publicly and if there's no lobbying allowed, then it's just people coming together, finding what's needed, then creating a syllabus, taking that before the medical school boards, and then following it with researchers who are seeing, is this being done honestly? And so there can be no backroom deals, no strong-arming, and no, you know, the AMA getting in there. This is the only way you're ever going to change the curriculum. Otherwise, it's a closed shop. You'll never get in, and if you got any good idea in by anyone, it'll be destroyed. So, it's an idea. Also, from the University of Calgary, they talked about hyper-hygiene environments are leading to chronic conditions. The children need microbes, not antibiotics, to develop immunity. And this is what they're saying. Yes, it's important to wash your hands. Yes, it's important to be protective when you're in cold and flu environments where people are sick. Absolutely. No one who's reasonable would suggest otherwise. But I had the advantage of growing up on a farm as well as in a little town. And when you're going into a barn every day and you're around animals and you're out and you're working in the lawns, and you're working gardening, you're putting your hands in the soil, you're bringing in microorganisms, you're bringing in dirt, and in that dirt are bacteria. And your body develops then a symbiosis with that bacteria. Study after study has shown that those who grow up in a more rural environment do not suffer the same adverse health effects as those who are not exposed to these natural environments. And you build a natural immunity. And that's important. Every morning when I wake up at 4 o'clock and then I exercise, I go out to the barn 7 days a week. And I prepare the animals' foods. And as one of the people said today, came in, he says, working here, he said, I've lost all this extra body weight. And he's from Cuba. And he says, this is the way we ate where I came from. You know, my father was very lean, still is. My father's lean, he said, and strong, because he eats lots of papaya. He says, I've never seen anyone give, you know, animals, papaya and watermelon and mango and apples and grapes and cherries and all this. A huge bowl, what, 10 pounds each bowl, and you got six of these? I said, yes. I said, normally an animal would go out and be given hay, which is very low in nutrition. That's like you eating iceberg lettuce. And then their whatever grass they have, and generally that grass is heavily sprayed with pesticides. So if you start the day by giving the animal an enormous amount of healing nutrients, they're going to stay healthy. And then let them eat grass, not hay. And don't give them grains. Grains will rot their gums and cause teeth to rot, and it's not good for them. This is what they need, just like a human. And all the animals get special protein shakes that I make for myself. What I drink myself, the animals get. As a result, there is Auntie, who is 32 years old. That's over 200 years in human life, the oldest living ring-tailed lemur that I'm aware of in the world. And should have died a long time ago, but I make sure that she gets what she needs, plus lots of attention, lots of affection. When you have an animal sanctuary where you're rescuing animals, bringing them back to a state of emotional and physical health, you have to spend time with them. So I spend time. And then finish that, and then the animal caretaker takes over, and I only hire animal whisperers. And that's a rare person. There are not a lot of them. They do exist, absolutely. And they are able to work with animals in a way that no one else was. They become the surrogate mother and father. And you see the animals perk up. They love these people. But in any case, it's all about that environment. That environment, when you're out in the pastures, you're grooming animals, you're brushing them down, you're hugging them, you're in the barn, you're picking up all those microorganisms. That's actually good for you because it's strengthening your immune system. Just like my mother took all of my brothers and us when we were babies and put us out in the cold in our baby cribs, because she knew that if we were left inside where it was very dry heat all day long, it would weaken our immune systems. So we were exposed as a result, never had a cold. None of us. Because we were hardy. So we've got to understand the parents today are creating these hyper-hygienic environments. And as a result, kids are not exposed to the natural environment where they can develop natural immunity and hence have natural strength in their immunity. That's what this study is showing. This is what it proves. Quote, "The problem is, in the West at least, parents have taken the business of keeping clean way too far. New science shows that blasting away the tiny organisms called microbes with our hand sanitizers, antibacterial soaps, liberal doses of antibiotics is having a profoundly negative impact on our kids' immune systems." This is according to a microbiologist and professor of this study, and at the University of Calgary. And they're saying that we're raising our kids to be cleaner, more hygienic, but hyper-hygienic, and creating hyper-hygienic environments than ever before. And they're overdoing it. And we are contributing to a host of chronic conditions ranging from allergies to obesity. And so, yes, you want to, as a kid, play in the dirt. That dirt is alive with microorganisms by the billions, and that helps strengthen the body's immune system. That does not mean we shouldn't practice hygiene. We should, but we shouldn't do it to an extent that we destroy natural immunity. We're 24 minutes into our program. Well, one last thing from Yale University, air pollution tied to higher risks of abnormal fetal growth, and it's serious. Because a lot of kids are dying each year from conditions because of pollution in the air. Heavy metals in the air, very dangerous for us. So just a heads up that wherever possible, have lots of plants, especially the ivies, in your house. because they absorb the heavy metals and give you oxygen instead, or a room air purifier, one that gets it down. Ideally, very difficult to get, but ideally 1 micron. More likely 3 microns. Not so good, 10 microns. Try to keep between 1 and 3 in an air filter, and one that would filter about 1,500 square feet. That's more than most people's apartments or houses, at least small house. Now, we don't have time today. I want to get a lot of my guest information in, but Paglia I'm going to play tomorrow. But I want to play the identity politics is really another form of narcissism. And this is a woman, Joanna Williams. We'll play her up until where we're going to go to our guest, and then we'll take a break and come back with the guest. Please listen. This is just one of many voices you would normally not hear, but I believe we can listen to them and agree or disagree. But this whole idea of censoring whole groups of people or anyone that would challenge us is very unhealthy for a society that provides forums and then turns around and decides that we're going to censor certain people from not getting on. That's not a good idea. Listen in, please.
Dr. Joanna Williams is one of my favorite writers on education, indeed on feminism. She's an academic, education editor of Spike. She's the author of Consuming Higher Education, Why Learning Can't Be Bought. So I'm going to get her to just give us a 60-second, what's your elevator pitch? Why does it agitate you? This identity politics?
Well, I'll just start by perhaps stating the obvious, but I think identity politics is everywhere nowadays, and we have seen it so much this weekend where nearly everybody who speaks in any of the discussions feels the need to preface their remarks by saying, speaking as a woman, speaking as a mother, speaking as an academic, and it's these kind of biological, often biological, but not always kind of assumed cultural identities that have really come to define each other, we use them to define each other. I don't think identity politics is eating itself. I wish identity politics would eat itself. And I think that there are two key things that I'd really like to bring out today that I think are problematic with identity politics, the way it's being framed today. The first is just it's incredibly limiting. It's about defining ourselves based on the most biological, the most boring aspects of our identity and not being able to move beyond that. This is not transformational, this is limiting. Second thing is that often claims to identity are based on victim status, and we become involved in what's termed a kind of oppression sweepstakes, where to be able to maintain our identity, we have to outdo other groups based on who is the most victimized. And I think that's incredibly unhelpful. One very, very final quick point. I actually think the name identity politics is wrong. I think this is nothing to do with politics. I think it's more about narcissism. It's about a complete obsession with the self, and we can't relate to the world other than how we see ourselves in it.
Okay, thanks, Jo.
It's the people who you might term the proper feminists, the second wave feminists, who I think are really responsible for a lot of this, because it's the second wave feminists with their slogan, the personal is political, that have really paved the way for the generation of feminists who you're now so scornful of, rightfully scornful of. But that slogan, the personal is political, and particularly the way that it's played out within academia, for example, basically said that any objective fact about the world is worthless compared to people's subjective experiences, and it's how people experience things in a very subjective way that counts. And obviously then you completely lose the ability to evaluate any concept, any knowledge, any political position, because it's all based on your feelings. It was really a case of bringing feelings into the classroom and feelings into politics. It's second wave feminists who really started this.
Joe.
I actually don't think there was ever anything good about the slogan, the personal is political. I mean, I think perhaps you could argue that it opened up a broader range of issues to debate. Arguably, that would have happened anyway. I think the personal is political was always terrible, and three reasons, and Julie's just outlined two of them very, very nicely. First of all, this idea that it pictures women as a class all women together as a class as opposed to all men together as a class. That's just rubbish. Women are not a class. I've got far more in common with many men than I have with plenty of other women. And by in common, I mean even in terms of kind of vested interests. If I want to secure a good life for myself, a good life for other people, I'm far better doing that by joining with men than by associating purely with other women. Second reason why I think nothing at all positive about the personal is political that Julie's identified is that it completely blurs the boundaries between public and private. And I think we're really seeing the consequences of that playing out in a lot of political issues that we see nowadays. So two of the debates I've been involved with this weekend have been looking at the issue of consent, sexual consent. And I think it's this whole notion that the personal is political that erodes the sphere between the public and private that makes things like sexual consent a suitable topic for a classroom discussion, that children should be taught about consent, and I really don't think that's at all helpful. Third reason is the thing that I touched upon earlier, that it moves the subjective, it privileges feelings and subjectivity above rationality and objectivity.
Okay.
So nothing positive about the personal is political.
Can I just...
I think these three questions that were posed down here about is there a difference between who you are, what you are and what you do are the kind of key questions which are people are expected to answer nowadays. But I think I'm not going to answer them, but I think the fact that they are the key question shows that one of the things I think really highlights, it drives this debate, is this collapse between the public and the private. And I think this is absolutely crucial. So this idea that you can't have a private life anymore, that your private life needs to be out in public, that you need to kind of wear as a slogan on a T-shirt exactly who you think you are and what you do at every available opportunity, and you can't have a kind of private sphere and a public sphere, I think it's really important. And I think what that has led to then is this culture of narcissism, and this culture of narcissism that is shaped by the collapse of the public and private, also shaped by the collapse of class politics. I think Judy had a really good way of summarising that. You know, what was important was the class you fought for rather than the class that you came from. You know, it's that collapse of class politics that has helped create this culture of narcissism. And I think the problem, my main problem with this, and I think it was really nicely encapsulated in the debate we had just earlier about rape culture, is people were asking about material politics. Where's the place for material politics nowadays? Well, it's nowhere, because we've got this emphasis on the subjective. So what was said on the panel in the rape culture discussion was it actually makes no difference whatsoever whether the rate of rape is 1 in 50 or 1 in 5, completely irrelevant, because all that matters is people's subjective experiences of living in a rape culture. So that way that you can completely disparage any objective fact means that material politics just doesn't happen anymore.
Sorry.
I think we've got to be very, very careful about saying that personal experiences are facts. I think there are some personal things that are facts. You can look at how much someone gets paid. You could look at how many times they were stopped by the police. You could look at how much they have to pay for their mortgage or their rent, etc. And you can look at facts in that context. As soon as we move beyond facts that can be weighed and measured like that, we move into the subjective sphere, and then you blur the lines between the subjective and the objective. And it's because that has taken place so much that we can even ask questions like, how do we politicise the experiences of different groups? Which I think is an interesting question. And I think it's, a question which stems from the dominance of identity politics. I think identity politics just gets in the way of real politics. I think the most important word that's been said in this debate so far was said over here about universalism. To my mind, politics is about winning people over to your argument. I mean, that's democracy, essentially. It's about winning people over to what you think by having those arguments out with people. But if we're all just defined by our own individual experiences and everybody's individual experiences are so different, then you don't actually ever attempt to do that thing of winning people over to your argument. You're just respecting people for their personal experiences.
So okay, leave it there.
Is my response...
Sorry, Claire, can I just come back on that very, very quickly? So if you look at the issue of gay rights, for example, you could look at the law, you could look at inequalities in the law, and those are social facts. Inequalities in the law are social facts. The only way you change that, though, is not by retreating into a space to say, I'm a gay man and I experience life as a gay man. You have to actually win the public over to your argument by saying...
Stop.
First of all, on the whole transgenderism issue, I think it's completely bonkers. I think the obsession with it is absolutely nuts. But I think it's quite a useful illustration of how identity politics leads to this complete disjuncture between ideas and reality, and also a nice illustration of how narcissism is driving identity politics, because essentially it seems to me the transgenderism thing is about saying everybody else in the world has to go along with my fantasies, and there's a real narcissism that underpins that notion. Secondly, on the cultural appropriation issue, and again this ties in with the gender issue, I think they're just terrible, absolutely terrible ideas that make me want to weep, because again there's an underpinning of narcissism there, but it also just shows how this whole identity politics becomes so fixed and so deterministic. So you have your culture, it's in a box, and you're not allowed out to that box. You're not allowed to aspire towards any culture that goes beyond that which has been assigned towards you. Finally, just on the pushback against identity politics, and completely agree, it's worse. The pushback that we're seeing nowadays in the form of MRA, in various other forms, often tends to be worse because it tends to be kind of hyper identity politics on acid. And I think the only way that we can truly get beyond identity politics is to make the case for universalism nowadays, and to look at what we've got in common rather than constantly obsessing about what it is that divides and separates us.
Okay. That's a person who has some very specific views. The idea is there anything that the person suggested that allows us to challenge our own views, to broaden them, or to disagree? We'll have more of these people on, and you'll have a chance on upcoming programs, but not today because of my guests going to take the rest of the program to share this. Now let's go over and say hello to the gentleman I introduced earlier, Professor Peter Edelman. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you. Very nice to be with you.
Today there are 10 million people who owe approximately $50 billion in court fees. And to put this figure into some kind of perspective, I'd like to begin with you explaining a phrase you have used, that is that the United States now has a modern system of peonage that is run by the government as a shark operation. And I feel it would be a good place to start there and have you expand upon what is meant by this institutionalization of peonage, which refers to working people who are bound to servitude because of debt, and yet that was supposed to have gone out of our consciousness in 1833, and it's still here. It's back with a vengeance. And also the government essentially taking on the role of loan sharks. The form is yours.
Thank you. Well, I am glad to be with you. The fact that essentially governments around our country have turned into loan sharks goes back to the Reagan period. Some of your listeners will remember Grover Norquist, who's still with us as a conservative, very conservative person, who said, "Let's shrink the government to the point it can be drowned in a bathtub." And what that was about was essentially starting the anti-tax rebellion that we had and still have in our country, which left, not that I sympathize very much with them in what they did, but since they could not tax anymore, the politics did not allow it, they started looking around, where can we get money, and particularly in the courts, but in smaller cities, the whole city government, like Ferguson, Missouri, which is where really I became aware of this. I've been working on poverty issues for decades, and this was brand new to me. I know about mass incarceration, but the fines and fees having jacked up to exorbitant fines and fees was new to me, but it was going on all over the country, and it took place because of the anti-tax rebellion. So what happens? People are arrested. They are tried for things that shouldn't be crimes at all or should be fines for $25 or $50. And they go initially into the hundreds and then into the thousands when they can't pay, and more payments to pay for, to be on probation and so on like that. And among other things, they get thrown in jail if they can't pay the fines. And so that's why we have this, the number that you started out with, which is really quite striking, isn't it? 10 million people, $50 billion they own. Oh.
It goes a little beyond that. Today we have 16.8 million children going to bed hungry in the United States. They're food insecure. We have 3.5 million children who go to school but have no home to return to. We have 178 million Americans who are at a slightly above or below the poverty level, and yet there is nothing being done that I can see in our Congress or at the state level or at the local level, certainly not in any of the media, to address these people's plights. And yet when I'm out there filming and interviewing these people, one woman had a $40 ticket, and she did not have the money to pay it. And therefore, they then compounded that. When she couldn't pay that, they arrested her into a private jail. She had to see a private probation officer and a private judge. And then each day in jail, she was charged, I think, $127. Her bill went from $40 that she could not pay to over $2,000. Her family had to get together and actually sell their cars in order for her to be able to get out of jail. And yet that was just one in a million, one of millions of people who are adversely affected each day by this. And they even have SWAT teams going to people's homes to collect debt. And who knew about this? We thought SWAT teams were for hostage situations or terrorist situations. And the vast majority of their arrests are for unpaid debt. Could you address these people and the fact that no one is paying attention?
You have, of course, nailed it. You've seen it yourself. And one fact is that most people around the country have not actually seen this. They may read something in the newspaper and so on, but they don't have the sense, and I think it's most people in our country don't have the understanding that this is a national problem and that stories like the one that you put out there unfortunately exist in one form or another in just about every state in our country. Now, I'd like to just build out one thing that you said, which is that you talked about the example of the every entity in that particular thing was for profit. And it is certainly true that there's vastly more for-profit everything from running prisons to running the probation and charging people if they get out on bail, they have to pay for the electronic bracelet, on and on and on. The thing that, and that's all terrible, we should not have it. People should not be making profits on these things. But, you know, the fact is that, let's just talk about probation for a minute. There are 13 states that have for-profit probation agencies, and that's 13 too many. But the fact is that 44 states charge to be on probation, and of course this isn't even real probation; it's just a way of squeezing for money. So let's be clear that the problem is way bigger than for-profit, as terrible as that is. Regular, if that's a word, regular agencies and the whole court structures in state after states are involved as public entities with the responsibility that they have as public agencies, and they're squeezing people to get money so they can run their court system or run their city or whatever it might be. So really, for-profit is bad enough, but the fact is it's going on almost everywhere.
Let's go a little further on that, because You mentioned the court fees. I've taken a look at the research, and I found that Oklahoma has 15 court fees. Florida right. has 20 new ones since 1996. Right. And then what are the short and long-term effects these fees have on people who are forced by the courts to pay them or wind up in the debtor's prison? And yet there's been three separate, at least that I'm aware of, three separate Supreme Court rulings that debtor's prisons are unconstitutional.
Well, yes. What you have, if what happens is the person is actually put into jail because he or she can't pay the fine and the fees, that's actually unconstitutional, among other things. But, you know, when we have as few, we're supposed to have public defenders everywhere in the country. There's a constitutional right to have a public defender. The Gideon decision, and we just don't live up to that. And so particularly in small communities, people get hauled into jail. They don't know what's going on. They don't know how to defend themselves. There is no public defender, or there is a public defender, but that public defender is on contract to the court. And so the so-called public defender actually works for the judge. And so the consequence is that even with these constitutional protections, they're simply the judges simply in too many places ignore them. That's how that works. And let me just add in terms of what this picture looks like. Actually, the biggest thing that we have in the country is not so much, oh, there's too much of it, where they put you in jail because you didn't mow your lawn, and there's plenty of that. But the thing that we see almost everywhere is taking away driver's licenses. And that is a particularly awful and effective tool, because once they get take away somebody's driver's suspension, which is often for something that has nothing to do with driving in the first place, or you know, maybe it's a broken taillight, but it's not anything where they're a danger to anybody. And once they have had it suspended, of course, they keep on driving because they have to get to work, they have to take the children to school, whatever it is. It's an awful system that just works, unfortunately, in this nasty way. It works really, really well. And in some places, like California, they actually didn't put people into jail. They squeezed them by taking money out of their paycheck, by taking away their state the refund for their taxes, and sticking a debt collection agency on them. And in California was the worst. They had 4 million people a couple of years ago added up. 4 million people, one out of six in the state of California. And you have similar things in states all over the country, over a million in Texas, Florida, North Carolina, almost a million in Virginia. So this is actually the tool that we see the most often, and it's the same thing because they get arrested again when they're stopped, and it piles up in just the way you said when you started the conversation.
You have said that Bill Clinton's welfare reform bill, which became an impetus for you to resign from the Clinton administration, was an expansion of Reagan policies. And as I recall, Clinton's Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act was almost the same as Newt Gingrich's Contract with America, which scraped a lot of the aid to families on welfare out of their bank accounts and back into the federal government. Now, I've interviewed Frances Fox Piven several times on this program, and she indicated to me when I interviewed her that Bill had adopted this bill primarily on Hillary's advice. It was Hillary who was the brains behind that relationship. And I don't know what the truth is. I wasn't there. So what happened was it assured that extreme poverty remains a prominent feature and presidential success story in the American landscape. And Bill's so-called 1996 welfare reform bill more than doubled extreme poverty while he was in office. And according to Frances Fox Piven, Bill Clinton adopted this bill in such a way that it would gain him some support with the Blue Dog Democrats and also some Republicans. But what we do have records showing is that under Clinton's 8 years in office, the average wage was 2% lower than under Reagan and Bush and 10% less than under Jimmy Carter. There was also a huge rise in unemployment among African Americans and over 40% by the time Clinton left office. And we also saw the prison system booming, especially among blacks, for minor crimes such as possession of a small amount of marijuana. So how much of the criminalization of poverty we witness today should at least in part be given to Hillary and Bill Clinton and their administration?
Quite a lot. There were, just as far as cash assistance is concerned, and you've already said it, but so people understand, we're now fewer than 1% of the American population are getting cash assistance, under 3 million people. When it was 14 million, which in my view was too high, but that's a different conversation. That's because we weren't helping people to get jobs. And instead of helping people get jobs, Clinton signed this awful bill that's essentially made in most of our country. There is no cash assistance, and you have 7 million people who have only food stamps, SNAP as it's now called, for their income, only food stamps, and that's a third of the poverty line. In other words, just a little over $6,000 a year for a family of three. So if we can certainly include the idea of criminalization of poverty in the way in which low income people were treated through that bill. And of course, that's why I quit. And unfortunately, I was correct about what was going to happen. I mean, not to get into the details, but poverty actually went down during the time that Clinton was there. And I don't give him any particular credit there. But the reason was because we actually had economic good times in the second his second term from 97 to 2000. And so poverty was down to 11.3%, mostly because the economy heated up and people were able to get jobs. That's just to put it into context. What he did to welfare, to cash assistance, was just unacceptable, absolutely terrible, and as you said, exactly right, that we have this phenomenally high deep poverty or extreme poverty, 15 million people, even after you take into account food stamps and the earned income tax credit, 15 million people who have incomes below half the poverty line, which is below $10,000 a year for a family of three. So that was terrible. And what Francis told you, by the way, when you have Francis again, say hello for me, a good friend, he's the one who gave us that outcome. And his reason for doing it, you were thinking out loud, or she has said to you, is essentially about his own reelection in 1996. He was evidently worried, even though there was every indication that he was going to get reelected. He wasn't going to take any chances. And so the reason, in my thinking, and I think I'm correct, is that he signed the bill because he wanted to make sure he would be reelected when he really didn't have to do it, and when a number of his own political advisors suggested that he should veto it. So this is really a bad thing.
Now, this is off the specific topic, but it still impacts people nonetheless. I just like your view on it, and that is asset forfeiture. I just looked at some of the latest figures, and it's up to $4 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm only referring to asset forfeitures from people who have committed no crime, were not given a ticket or summons. In other words, they weren't arrested. They just simply were stopped in their assets, sometimes a car, 10,000 cars, their cash. And now in the state of Oklahoma, they actually had this little machine that they could carry on them, that they would ask for all your credit and debit cards and put them in the machine, and it would immediately withdraw all the money out of your bank account into theirs. And the only way you could fight that is you'd have to hire a local attorney, go into court, and that could cost you sometimes thousands of dollars. And what if you didn't live there? What if you were just driving through a place and you got stopped, and then they said, well, we suspect that this you might have this cash because you had use of drugs, and you say, I'm just driving home. That $1,000 came from a bank account. I can show you, well, but how do we know how you made that $1,000 besides this road that you're on is used by drug traffickers, and that gives us the right to stop any car and search it, and we have the right to make any seizure. And the government then splits that, the federal government with the state government, and then the state government splits that with the local people, who the local police department. And I'm looking at this, and this has been going on for a long time, and there's not a peep about this, about asset forfeiture. And I think, and especially if you're a poor person and you don't have money to begin with, and they take whatever little you have, then that really is reprehensible. Your thoughts?
I agree. We had a wonderful piece that Sarah Stillman did in The New Yorker. You probably read it a couple of years ago, but it hasn't gotten enough attention. The federal government's policies under Obama really reduced the amount of, as far as the federal government was concerned, asset forfeiture. But Sessions, the attorney general we have now, is now putting it back in at full speed again. So the as far as the feds are concerned, we had started finally to go in the right direction, and now he's backpedaling, going in the wrong way. It's very serious, and the ways in which we get at people, payday loans is another one. A number of states assist private debts that are owed, credit card and other things, can be turned into crimes in a number of states, and then you get into the same thing that I wrote about in terms of the fines and fees. And these things are all kind of related to each other, and they're fundamentally all ways to get money from the to squeeze from people to run these levels of government. It's just terrible.
Just as a final point for our conclusion today, what can this audience do and others should be doing to push back on the system of debt peonage and the unconstitutional fines and fees in the prison system, and they're cutting into welfare funding as well?
Well, number one, we need people like you and others, journalists, who lift these things up. And we need people to be aware of all this so that they would join in organizing to push back on these things. We do have a lot going on in the country, as much as we have a long way to go. But we now have 12 lawsuits against the constitutionality of money bail, which you and I didn't talk about, which is a huge problem in our country. And we've had two major, major decisions there in Texas and California. And so we have lawyers, we have legislators who are working on these various things. California has reduced the number of people whose driver's licenses have been taken away. And chief judges and people, even in the South, Texas, Mississippi, Atlanta, and so on, have taken us in the right direction. So the fact is, what we need is for public awareness and for them to push back at their elected people.
I certainly appreciate that. That makes sense. This is going to be a long effort because no one wants to give up the money they've taken. No court system, no judge, no bailiff, none of these people. They're all profiting off the poor in this country, and that's just a crime against humanity, in my opinion. Thank you for all the good work that you do, and your book is certainly a must-read. It is called Not a Crime to Be Poor, the criminalization of poverty in America, and we've been doing that for a long time. Let us hope that we develop a consciousness to fight back on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Professor Peter Edelman in Washington, D.C. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.